condition, my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. Oh.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back to you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Blown up by Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holly, just met Weber on the board. SP Futures down 15, NASDAQ Futures down 84, Dow Futures down 91. This is after a very rare down day yesterday, but we have a down morning here. We have the CPI number coming in this morning, and PPI came in hotter than expected yesterday, and... just plain hot, and I think it's probably hotter than they're telling us, but that would just be me. Kevin, how are you?
Good morning. I, too, am hotter than anyone's telling you.
I'm going to have to get the female version of that, see if they vote the same way.
Don't be telling them, either.
They might say, that dude's hot. It looks old to me. You know, just saying.
That's okay. Funny story. A friend of ours, you know, Mark. And this goes back, though, you know, probably 15, 20 years. But he was sitting someplace having lunch with his sister, and a very attractive young woman walks by, and of course his eyes follow her all the way. And his sister, as soon as he looked back at his sister, she says, "She looks at you and just sees old."
Now, then again, if you're from the Coach Redmond school, if you got dough, they'll work with you.
Perhaps.
Maybe a lot of dough. Anyway, what are those kind of... I always loved those marriages, or was curious. Well, the best one had to be the guy who... who knows the best one, but one of them was... Talk about going off topic here, like before we even have a topic. I don't know if she's still alive. I haven't checked lately, but there's still somebody who is getting a... Some lady who is getting a check from Civil War. And there's actually, you know, say who the hell cares, but it's actually fairly interesting that in those days when the soldier who was on the pension died, for some reason the pension would go to your kids, which is, you know, I don't know what the logic was to that, but the fallback position was I don't think they get any cost of living. So anyway, there's this guy who fought, you know, Civil War. I think he might have started out on the Confederate side, ended up on the, I don't know, but he was real young. And when he's in his 70s, he marries this lady who's like 19. And I don't know what the motivation there was, but, you know, maybe he had dough, I don't know. But he ends up with like 3 kids. This is before the little purple pill. And he, and the guy went to, he went to the 75th anniversary of Gettysburg. He showed up. And I think one of her kids is still alive or something I think the kid is, somebody's still alive in Ohio who's like 100 years old, and they're getting but the check's only like $13, which is weird. So there hasn't been any accretion on the check, which is even more bizarre. What's the point? But anyway, there's, I don't know if she's, so just goes to show you, I don't think this 19 or 20 year old lady expected to have 3 kids with this guy. Didn't, what's his name? Strom Thurmond, the old center. Didn't he marry some lady who was like in her early 20s when he was 70? And he lived till he was 90, and they have like 3 kids or something? don't know if that was.
I don't know the story on that either, Tom.
But I
you, know, you follow things that I just don't.
Well, I'm just when it happened, I'm sitting there going, God, you know, because we were young at the time, and I'm going, why does this girl want to marry this old dude? And then he's a senator, I guess. I don't know, but I just wonder if you would interview her. By the way, were three kids part of this plan? I mean, you know, I don't know. It just maybe they were. I don't know. You don't want to judge people, but it would seem like that's not going to happen. But it did, you know. So anyway, so there you go. So we're starting a Wednesday out on that. We've got
we are here to inform and instruct.
Well, but there's odd things all over the place, and to a certain extent, they're interesting. I don't know if they're necessarily their news. We got the CPI number coming out today, and
it's as newsy. Yeah, it's as newsy as half the crap that's on the news.
Well, that's I think we're somewhat being overwhelmed by this. I guess when you it points out sort of weaknesses in the system, Kevin. Like even in like new car sales, I don't know that anybody. Just for those of you, I don't want to go into a whole lecture on how cars are priced, but because it also is pretty interesting. But anybody who's bought a car, which I think most of the people in the listening to the show have, when you go in, there's something called the manufacturer's suggested retail price. Okay, and it usually, unless you get on rare occasions, you're going to get a very very hot car that there's not enough of for whatever reason, and all of a sudden the thing will go out for at or close to the manufacturer's retail price. I remember when we were in high school and college, you remember Dave Ward, Woody?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
His dad was the manager of the Evergreen Park Volkswagen dealership. And in those days...
Yeah, he used to sell them in the summer. That was his summer job.
Yeah. And in he started out putting what they used to call the crappy asphalt they used to spray in the bottom, undercoat. He was the undercoat guy.
He's the undercoat guy, so it was sort of like in Fargo. You know, he'd sell people, he'd try and twist people's arms into getting undercoats.
Which you know, in those days when the metal was worse, it probably wasn't a bad idea. But I think he said the stuff used to cost him $3, and they were paying him $1.80 an hour. I think the undercoat was $75. It took up an hour, so it was pretty high profit item. Anyway. But I think all the Volkswagens went at list. You walked in and whatever was on the window, that's what you paid. But I think for most, realize that you want the list to be higher than the actual price. The reason for that is if somebody comes in with a used car that's underwater, so say the manufacturer's price is 50 and the real price is going to be like 44 or 42 or something. Well, if you come in with a car that is only worth say 9, but you owe 10 on it, you've got some room there to put your loan into the new car, correct? I don't know how many people know that that's the game, but that's the game. But, so you don't really get, I would think that when your CPI goes to look at car prices, my guess is, Kevin, that they've always tracked the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So right now, even if they were truthful, and let's say for a moment, since it's a nice Wednesday morning, that they are, even if they were truthful, I don't know if they have the mechanism to handle something that's going on right now, to where there's a shortage of cars, and a lot of people are paying either the manufacturer's retail price or over. So let's use the example again. If the car's got a $50,000 price on it, and in normal times, it goes out the door for 42 or 43, if you went in and just paid cash, and now you're paying 50 or more, you really have got a 20% increase in the price of the car without even anything on the paperwork. Because I don't think the CPI looks at the actual bill of sale, do they? How could they? I mean,
you could do that now, but I doubt that they've adapted to doing it. I mean, it wouldn't be hard if because you have to, you have to file a lot of paperwork, or not paperwork, electronic paperwork. How's that? Electronic paper. What a concept! But you have to, you have to file. You have to collect sales taxes. You got all of that, so you know what the price was. You can probably net out, reasonably. And in this era of, processing large amounts of data. It's doable. You know, is anybody doing it? I doubt it.
But why would anybody... I'm going to lob this one out there. Let's say people are quote, lazy or underfunded. How's that for... I'll use that term. I mean, the SEC never does a bad job. They're just always underfunded, right? There aren't enough people. I mean, if you buy that, I got a bridge for you. But I don't see how for, 100 years of car buying, they ever could have kept track of what people actually paid for the damn thing. And I think they're going to keep track of the price that's on the window, the sticker price. Just saying. So what I'm attempting to do here is when you look at the CPI numbers, even if you don't assume fraud, it's a very, very difficult job to do correctly. Right, Kevin? I mean, I think it's easy to find the retail price of brown rice or white rice or yellow rice or that sort of thing. I mean, if you just go out and sample it. But I think there's other stuff here, big items, that it's not so easy. I don't know that it's easy to pin a hospital down into, okay, what is the price of an appendectomy? Well, everybody's different. Man, you got this and that, and this guy needs it. I mean, I think there's a lot of areas in there that are really hard to pin down. Even if you and I were, and half of the listeners, if we said, okay, we're going to do this job right, I think we'd have a problem, right? I mean, because it's a hard job to do, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, if you were going to convert over to accuracy, then it would be, you'd be talking about a few years of systematically going through different kinds of pricing and setting up the mechanism for collecting the data. Like I said, it's doable. Is it being done? Of course not. And is it worth doing? I don't know. Are we just fine with a sampling methodology or something like that?
Well, I mean, and then you come down to the point where, all right, I'll be nasty. Are we paying for a good job and getting a horse bleep job? I mean, if we have five guys that are, or ladies that are working their fannies off, I guess we're okay. But if we've got a whole building full of people and they're all working from home and not doing crap, well, then I guess we're paying for it anyway. We might as well get a good job, right?
It would be nice. That would be pretty deluxe, I think.
But I'm not so sure how you, after all this time, because you got... There's a yin and a yang here. It's sort of like the Fed. They're looking for full employment and they're looking for no inflation. Well, that's, of course, they're not doing any of that now, but that's another story. But there's a yin and a yang here. You also want to keep the CPI in some semblance of stability, so you can compare year over year. I mean, it would be very difficult. I mean, I'm not so sure what would we do if we were chairing the meeting and we've got, 10 of our workers in there and they're actually dutiful people, and one guy says, it looks to me like people are paying less now, and I'm even hearing rumors that people are paying more, and I've got a couple of bill of sales to prove it. What are we going to do, coach? and you and I are sitting there, with our finger on our lips going, blah, 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 Well, I don't know what you do, Kevin, because if we now say, oh, we're going to use the bill of sale, how do we compare that to, 1972 when we're using the MSRP? I don't know. I guess I don't know. In other words, we also,
unless those records are, what do I want to say? Unless those records are available and stored online, if they were, then you could go back and you could recompute the model based on the new criteria, and you could retrofit it to it, and it's sort of like, if you were investigating earnings history for a company. And you wanted to correlate it to stocks, what would you do? Well, I actually, because they restate earnings all the time, I'd probably want to know rather than correlate, earnings as we know it today, I'd want to know earnings as it was announced at the time, and see what that, if that's any, if there's any advantage in that versus the, working with the restated earnings. The only way you know is to go do it.
Well, yeah, I don't know how you could find out what my parents paid for their 79 Oldsmobile. I have no idea, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, again, all that was filed, was paper records once upon a time. Do those paper records exist? Were they ever transcribed to online? And I tend to doubt it. There's always some cutoff where you say, we'll go back this far and digitize all the...
the dealership's been...
You're not going to go back to what your parents did when you were a kid. I don't see... There's probably not any value in doing that.
Plus, the dealership's been gone for 30 years, so is the word, though, if there ever were any records. Plus, you know, in the financial industry, I took my test many years ago, but I think you're supposed to keep, God, I should know this. It's 7 years and 3 years in an easily grabbable place or something like that. Some of these companies, absolutely, on the seventh year in one day, can't wait to throw all that stuff out.
Yeah, you know why that is?
Because if you actually have it, and you know, it's subpoenaed, you have to come up with it, even if you're not supposed to have it.
Yeah, even if you're past the retention date, you have to provide it if you're not subpoenaed. And that habit goes back to the days when the compilation was a big manual process. And even though you could build the courts for it, if you were a small bank or something, you could tie up, for weeks, you could tie up a couple of people pulling together financial records. So, yeah, you didn't, you always wanted to be able to say, nope, out of retention, and we destroyed those records. So that was standard practice. Now it's all digitized. You know what? You do a query, you get the records, and you scribe them to disk and give them to somebody. So it's not the same chore it used to be. Now people are, I am sure that the financial institutions are still in the habit of destroying the records on the retention date, but that's not as necessary as it once was.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you're not going to get those guys to say we want to keep them forever. You know, I guess my theme here, if anybody can find it this morning, is when you look at the economics of all this, and you look at the economics of prices, and you look at what people, I don't sense really out of, who knows, Kevin, the people I talk to, maybe either socially or whatever, or people you run into at the coffee shop or the library or the church, shall we say. You don't get this fine sense of, shall we say, knowledge of what economics really is. Because, like, if you, for instance, if somebody's, I'll use the median price, if somebody's making $37,000 a year, and all of a sudden, and he's driving X to where his gas bill every month has gone from $60 to $100, or to $110 or something, because it's almost doubled. Say $60 to $100. And you might see, the saloon down the block from the guy sees him instead of three nights a week, now two nights a week. And so you'll say that, because everything you do affects something else economically. You constantly have to think of, well, you don't have to, but you should think of all the stuff that goes on in a free market economy to the extent that ours still is, and you could certainly make the argument that it isn't in some areas. Everything you do affects something else. So even if you think, obviously if you're making $1 million a year, whether the gas thing is $100 when you fill up or 80, it probably doesn't make that much difference to you. But somewhere along the line, it does, and it's part of a decision to somebody. And if there might be a bar owner that says, boy, Matty Weber's in here every Tuesday night. Where the hell is he? Might be having his three beers and a burger. Well, he and Jill might have just gone out and filled up their two Suburbans today, and it's 80 gallons, times another dollar a gallon or whatever it is. Well, that's the $80 they would normally have spent on Tuesday night at the bar. I mean, everything affects everything else in the economic world, and it's surprising that I never hear anybody refer to that. But I would like to have on Monday.
Well, I think a lot of that ties back to because we count on media to report this. And it ties back to what you and Jeff discussed yesterday, that you don't have people with subject matter expertise doing the reporting. So their training is in asking questions and getting answers, and they don't push real hard in general. They don't push very hard, and a lot of that has to do with needing access. If I don't have especially in national media, when you work your way up that food chain, man, you've worked really hard to get into the club, and the only way you're going to get knocked out of the club is that nobody wants to talk to you, nobody wants to give you any stories, even off the record, and so you don't push, you don't put people on the spot. You just basically, you're delivering, you're a messenger. You become a messenger, but you're a messenger who's a proud member of the club.
Well, but I think, Kevin, when you have a situation like we do now, especially in the municipalities, and in the federal government, when they start, in whatever bump in Congress who designs tax law, if you don't look at the ramifications and you don't follow up on some of the research, how do you know whether you're on foot or horseback, to be perfectly honest with you? I'll take an example. There's a great little Italian place. You know, there's better ones around, but it's a good one. The people around the place are terrific. It's Club Lago over on Superior and Franklin. Okay, so it's a great bar, Kevin, in the sense that if you walk in, the people who work on that block are either architects or attorneys. So you can walk in by yourself, sit down with somebody, say hello to the guy next to you or lady next to you, and within 5 minutes you're learning about some new building that's going up and any kind of advances in architecture, and you can learn a boatload in the place just by going there and having a beer. You know, it's one of those kinds of places, which of course I love. And other people say, let's see, I'm going to talk about architecture or law when I go have a drink. But, you know, for me, it's terrific. Now they keep raising these parking rates in front of the place. So if I stop for a beer, it's $10 to park there in the street. Now, I'm going to say I'm down to one night a month, you know, when I used to be four or five. Now, the question is, am I the only guy who's cheating Guido, who owns a place, five nights a month, or are there 50 people like me? There's probably not 50, but are there 20 or 30? Well, if there's 20 or 30, now you're talking about 150, you know, fannies in the bar stool a month. Now, you're losing money. Where it used to be $5 and I didn't really pay any attention, but now $10, I'm like, give me a freaking break. $10 to sit down and have a beer? I mean, I'm not even paying for the beer. Are you working against yourself to the point where now the bar's doing worse? So maybe you can't raise the property taxes on the bar. You're paying tax in there. You're not getting that. I mean, when you start piling on like all these places are doing, do you think they have any idea whether they're actually hurting themselves or not?
You know what? No, I don't think. I don't think they do. I really don't. And because not only do the reporters lack subject matter expertise, so do a lot of the politicians. You know, there are some that are totally expert in what they do, but a lot of them don't. And so if you know, it's one thing to have an agenda and to know what you think is right. And what you think, you know, what the people you want to support and so on. But then when you have to start dealing with messy questions like, well, how am I going to pay for this? You know, how am I going to make the, you know, what am I going to do to make this work? Then you're strictly operating in an ideological world without any common sense behind it. And so you're doomed to what you just described on a very micro level, what you just described on a macro level, the reconciliation bill that they're trying to push through now.
But how do you, especially if the money, like for the parking, if it goes to a third party, and every time you raise the amount to go to the third party, if you've had first grade economics, if there is such a thing, you know you're cutting back on your revenue. Because to any extent that there's a reaction to the higher price, it directly affects you. How does somebody sign something like that? I mean,
it's like saying, I'm gonna raise my prices, higher than the market will bear, and the first few sales I get, I'm really, really happy with it. But then when I get to the end of the month and I realize that the number of units I sold resulted in less revenue, the difference is that if I'm running a business that way, I'm gonna scale my prices back down and hope I didn't drive away too many customers in the process. In government, it's encoded into law. It's it doesn't go away ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, this week, if you look at what's happened to the interest rates, I mean, I would say that if you could have, then we'd have to have, maybe we'll have Nancy on, Audrey's friend, on Monday, because she's in the mortgage business. This thing in the last week has been one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in the market. We had the the Fed coming out and saying, yeah, we're going to do this taper thing. They acknowledged that they're behind the ball on the inflation. They didn't say they're going to do anything about it, but they acknowledged it and they're going to watch it. Okay, so it was kind of a mealy-mouthed sort of delivery. But where exactly did you get a period where you're going to have 3 or 4 days where the interest rates went flying down and not up after what they did is startling to me. Now they're coming back the other way yesterday and today a little bit. And I caught a piece of that for my clients, which is nice. I mean, if you were in the queue, you probably could have locked in a mortgage in the last 4 or 5 days that, maybe you haven't been able to get for a while, and maybe you might not be able to get ever. Who knows about that, but I mean, it probably was really good for that industry for 4 days. I mean, if you weren't busy doing mortgages in the last 4 days, you're never going to get busy. I'm sorry, you know. That's why I want to maybe have Nancy on Monday to find out how. But all this little stuff, these maneuvers, if you didn't think that it would have been a good idea for you to refinance, maybe if you'd have kept your eye on the ball the last few days, it might have been. You know, because this, everything is changing so weird here, Kevin. You sort of have to take advantage of it when it happens. And now you might be sitting there going, gee, should I get a refinance? But a lot of these policy moves and the unintended consequences or the almost opposite consequences, you sort of have to keep your eye on. I mean, fortunately, we didn't have any position being short bonds, or long interest rates, for lack of a better term, when this happened the last few days. But, I mean, yesterday I just said, oh man, this TLT is like 152 and a half or 53, but I've never seen it that high. So we did a little something, and now it's down to 150 today. Who knows? I might go right back up and, stick my position right where the sun don't shine. But as of now, it looks fine. But hey, what do you make of, I don't know if you're watching some of these Let's do break first. S&P futures down 11, NASDAQ futures down 76. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello, everybody. Stocks and jocks. I'm Tom Ollies. Mr. Brett Weber on the board. S&P futures down 1350. NASDAQ futures down 86. Dow futures down 61. Individual stocks. Nothing sort of crazy in the Dow. A couple here I will give everybody, though. The we've got Coinbase is down like 9%, down $31. Poshmark, whatever those guys are, they're down 30%, down $7. Fubo is down 8%. DoorDash is up 14%. So we're getting some movement out of some of these earnings. And there's been a few trap doors where stocks have really come down. So, you know, keep your eye on what's happening in some of this stuff, especially if you're in a lot of these stocks. I mean, some of them, I've been talking about, I think they're a little too high. So sometime on the earnings, even the earnings come out allegedly good, the stocks are going, wow, people are saying it's not enough. So you wonder if there's a little repricing about to happen here, and who knows. A couple times it looks like it's going to, and then it never does. So, but maybe this is it. DAX down 15, let's call that flat. FTSE up 31.4%. Kekaran down 28.4%, so mixed to nothing over there. Again, we got the CPI number coming out at 7:30. We're in Asia, we got the Nikkei down 178.6%. They've been pretty volatile the last several weeks. Shanghai down 14.4%. Hang Seng, however, up. They're the ones that are usually down. We're up 183.7%. So the Chinese developer Fantasia, They came back and they started trading again, but now they're down. He's developed it. That's like three of them now. A lot of these guys have this dollar-denominated debt, and it's very difficult to find out who exactly has. I hope our Fed is on this. They should know, you know, who has what kind of loans there are over there. It's not very difficult for any of us to know, but they should know, I hope. Yesterday, Dow was down 112, S&P down 16, Nasdaq down 95. So down day, but not very much, 0.3, 0.6%. Bonds actually up 2 basis points today to 1.47, and we've got the Bund actually unchanged at minus 0.29, Japan unchanged at minus 0.0, positive 0.05, although way different than it was a week ago. Oil down 72 cents, 83.43, Brent down 43 cents, 84.35, natural gas down 9 cents, 4.88, still, well, it's going to back down. Now they've had a big drop. They were 6.09, 498, 598, and now they're at 488 again. It's an amazing volatility in this natural gas, something I've never seen. RBOB down a penny to 235. Gold down 340, but still 1827. Silver down 9 cents, 2422. Copper unchanged, 436. And finally, Bitcoin down 466, but still at 66,663, which is pretty darn high for recently. Maddie, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
37 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. We're off to a great start after a crazy morning yesterday with some serious crashes. This Wednesday morning is getting off to a good start here with no delays on the Edens. Same could be said for the Kennedy. We're seeing some traffic building on the Eisenhower and Stevens Inn, but no accidents to report. Southside expressways are looking good, as is Lakeshore Drive. The only crash in the area is up north, North Waukegan Road at Oakton Street. Which is Illinois 43, there is a crash. But everything else is all quiet out there. Weather today, sunshine early, then we could get some clouds later on. A high of 56. Right now it is clear and 52 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 84 today. Right now it's clear and 57. In sports, the Blackhawks have won two in a row. They beat the Penguins at home last night, 3-2 in a shootout. Blackhawks are now 3-9-2 on the season. Obviously, two games better than they were a couple games ago, but still a lot of ground to make up. Bulls were off last night. They'll host the Mavericks tonight, 7 p.m. at the United Center. Bulls have the best record in the Eastern Conference, tied with a couple of other teams at 7-3. Suns were off last night. They're back in action tonight as well, as they'll host the Blazers. That's a 7 p.m. Phoenix time tip-off. The defending Western Conference Phoenix Suns are 6-3 on the early season. College hoops tipped off last night for hundreds of teams, not every team, but most of them. Number 11 Illinois beat up on Jackson State 71-47. Northwestern blew out Eastern Illinois 80-56. Loyola crushed Coppin State 103-45. And then there was a couple of upsets that
103-45. Who is Coppin State? You and me?
There's some team out of Baltimore we talked about yesterday. But there was a couple of upsets. I don't usually give out the Northern or Western scores. But both of them had major upsets last night. Western Illinois upset Nebraska out of the Big Ten 75-74. And Northern Illinois went to Seattle and upset Washington 71-64. So congrats to those teams.
Chief. I have a question for you, you gambler sorts. I'm watching the Hawks last night, and between periods, the Hawks had, I don't know what happened in the first period, but I was watching it, but I was doing other stuff. And they have a huge report between periods of how the line has changed during the first period and how you can make your bet then. Who pays for that?
They're sponsored by PointsBet. PointsBet pays for that.
But, I mean, the announcers are doing are they paying those guys directly or just regular sponsors? I mean, what?
They're regular sponsors, just like a live read. And they're doing it at the Bulls games, too. So all the NBC Chicago, they struck a huge deal with PointsBet. And not only do they do live reads of the game for the betting odds at halftime or between periods, they do it before the game as well. And then their logos are on the ice and on the floor.
Is there something they think has happened to human nature in the last 100 years that all of a sudden players and referees and coaches are now impervious to this? That the gambling can absolutely surround the sport and it won't have any problems?
It's a good question.
I mean, well, I doubt they're impervious, but I don't know that they were ever impervious. So,
I think that the players and coaches make so much money now that they are impervious. Whereas 100 years ago they didn't, and so they weren't. Like, would you throw your... If you're making $15 million a year, is it really worth it to throw your career away to throwing a game? I would say no, but if you're making...
Yeah, that's a good point, Matt. I mean, you'd have to have some kind of... you'd have to be in some kind of compromised position to have to do that.
Right.
And none of them are.
And it doesn't mean that you're completely impervious. I'm with you. You can always find someone. But I'm saying the likelihood is just so much lower now because guys are making so much money. I don't think you would risk throwing your whole career away for throwing a game when you're making that much money. But, you know, it doesn't make it impossible.
I will
Well, and people do, you know, people do that for their various addictions like crazy. I mean, you know, the one I used to do when my kids were young, and I'd always tell them, you know, when you're talking about using drugs, that... you know, you're going to look around, you're going to see people that you know who are using and they seem to be just fine, and you're going to look around and you're going to see you know, athletes who are still really good athletes and students who are really good students. But you don't, first of all, you don't know where they're going to be 5 years from now, and some of them are still going to be fine and some of them are not. But the other thing is, if you ever wanted the example of, you know, how much power a drug, the cocaine, would have over you, as an example. Just look no further than the story of Roy Tarpley. And I don't know if you guys remember Roy Tarpley, but he was an all-star NBA player and a first-round draft pick and making a lot of money, and he drug-tested out of the league. In those days, the policy was that you could go turn yourself in the first time, and you would go to rehab and you'd stay on the payroll, and you could turn yourself in the second time and you'd be off the payroll but go to rehab and then get reinstated, and third time you're out. Well, he got up to that, you know, and if otherwise they had to go to arbitration and order a test if your team suspected that you were using. And so and then you were you know, you would be subject to next time you're out. So he was at that last time, that last chance, and you're subject to regular testing, so you know you're going to get caught. And you have to make the choice between making millions of dollars playing basketball or using the drug, and he chose to use the drug, which tells you how powerful it is. So I tell that story just to say you don't know how compromised some people can get, and what they have to when it seems like they have everything to lose and they still make some really bad choices.
It's a huge problem on the trading floor at one time, a massive problem. But I mean, it's interesting, though, Maddie, when you say that, that makes total intuitive sense. But I don't know that it's right. You know, I mean, reason why I say that is years and years ago, I was listening to these people give a report on individual families, well, people and families, that and what they said. Okay, what would it take if I were to write you out a check to make your life, you know, less stressful? We're not talking about buying you a yacht or anything like that. And, you know, it was a serious question to where they got people down to where, you know, it wasn't like a focus group or anything. It was a serious discussion. And they came, I don't know how many people that they interviewed, but a boatload. And they came out with this is fascinating. I would never have guessed this. So I would have said the same thing you just said, Mitty. They said at every level of income, now maybe not if you're Bill Gates, but at every level of income, the number came down to be like 20% of a year's salary. That whether you make 40 grand or 400 grand, that's about how much you're overextended. That if somebody made 40 grand and you gave them a check for 8,000, that's probably where he is ahead on his credit card. It's probably where he can pay off the 58 Chevy and he and his wife can go to the Dells for a weekend and everybody's happy. But if you're 400 grand a year, you really didn't need the last SUV, the Porsche SUV. It's like the same number percentage-wise. It almost doesn't matter what you make, how much you're ahead of the game, how much you are ahead of yourself. Now, I don't know if that would make any difference, but you remember when Lou was in, when was the strike? Was that like 8 or 9, the football, what, they strike for like 2 weeks or something? Or we're going to?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It's been a long time, but Lou was in, I think, and he said, these guys are broke. The reason why the NFL can't get the same kind of labor agreement that baseball does is because the guys can't go out on strike because they're broke. They immediately, even though they made $30 million last year, if they miss one paycheck the next year, they're asking their agent for a loan. So you can't make the blanket statement that because somebody's making $5 million a year, when the season starts, they haven't pissed away to $5
million. No doubt.
I almost think it might be worse.
The question is, do you protect the paycheck or do you get involved with the gamblers? And I think that there's a rationality to saying I'm going to protect the paycheck and not get myself compromised. And they're, of course, getting admonished to it. But that doesn't mean everybody, you know, it's going to be everybody. There's going to be some who get so compromised. And it's who has you compromised to? Are you compromised to the people who, it's one thing to be overextended. It's another to be beholden to the people who want to fix the game.
But it could be so innocuous. I mean, what if you went to Matt Nagy, okay, and you said, and I wouldn't accuse him, he seems a pretty honest guy, but if you went to Matt Nagy and say, here's what I want you to do. This game is 8 points. And if you bumps are down by 9, I don't want you kicking a field goal to make it 5. I want you to go for it on fourth down. If you make it, that's fine. But I want one decision this game. I just want one. Whether you kick it when you shouldn't. I mean, the greatest line in his, of course, he was so powerful you couldn't say anything about him. Coach Paul Bear Bryant, Alabama was favored. You remember this, Kevin. They were favored by like 35 or something. And they're up by 34. With like 2 seconds to go and under the other guy's 30-yard line. So they bring out the kicker and they kick. And so they kick the field goal, so they win by, whatever, 37. So the guy, newspaper guy says to Paul Bear, his coach, you're up by like 34 with like 2 seconds to go. What did you kick a field goal for? And he goes, son, I know the point spread was 35, and I know how many Alabama boys bet on Alabama, so I gave them their day, or something along those lines. So it's not like people have ever been totally clueless to this ever, I don't think. That part I agree with you. But I mean, it's decisions like, there's a lot of decisions you can make. For instance, I mean, I would never accuse Mike Bray either, but say, for instance, you know, the Irish are going to play Coppin State, and they're up by 25. They're 25-point favorites. He could put the third string in at halftime and win by 18. You'd never know. I mean, and you wouldn't change the outcome of the game. You wouldn't. I mean, you could do this in a way where you just have a little edge going for you, and you'd never know. I don't think. Or am I wrong?
Right, and that's a form of point shaving, and yeah, that you wouldn't know, and you know, and that could be, you know, a source for anybody. But again, you know, how much is a coach going to do that? There's got to be something else going on. Now, if they have all the dirt on you for the players that you've bought, you know, and the recruiting violations that you've had, then maybe they are going to get your arm twisted on that. And so, yeah, I'm not saying it's out of the realm of possibility.
Or what if Mike Bray, which I
think it's way more susceptible in the college game, and I've always thought that, because the players aren't making any money. And and then, you know, there's, like you said, there's different ways coaches can do things, but you're not seeing the gambling sponsorships as in your face at the college level as you are in the pro level. I'm not saying they don't exist, but
I don't disagree. I'm just saying, but you can't make the assumption that just because Michael Jordan made $27 million a year, he's not hacked to a casino.
No, it's true. Also, my good buddy,
or that he's not in hock to people who will break his legs if he doesn't play right. Ball with them.
Right. Yeah, and that stuff has probably happened a bunch of times that we don't know about over the course of sports history. My buddy Tim Doyle played basketball at Northwestern, and he told me that he was approached once when he was playing to shave points. And you know, he didn't have any money, and he told me honestly, he was like, yeah, I mean, I did think about it for a second, but he's like, I think he said, you know, something like they were going to offer him like $10,000, which when you're in college, that's a lot of money.
That's huge, though. That's huge.
And he was like, but in the grand scheme of things, he's like, there's no way it's worth it to do that for $10,000. I would never consider it, because if you get caught, it tarnishes your name for the rest of your life. Is that?
You're a pariah everywhere you go.
Yeah, and so he was like, they could offer me 10 times that, and I wouldn't have done it.
Unless you're A-Rod and you can recreate yourself.
But here's the other thing is, because I remember when Northwestern had its point shaving scandals. You know what? You can't be involved in point shaving. It's not point shaving if you're the underdog.
Yeah.
Well.
Because you may be affecting the point spread, you may be doing that, but in so doing, you're also giving away the game. You're precluding the chance of winning by losing by more than the spread. So that's called throwing the game.
Yeah.
Well, I think the approach would be, especially if somebody is inherently honest and just got themselves in trouble, it could be a medical bill. You know, it could be anything. I mean, if somebody's in here, you bring it up in such a way where you're never going to mess with the outcome of the game. You're just going to mess with the outcome of the point spread or the over-under, something like that. You know what I'm saying? You'd have to approach somebody in such a way where you're never going to throw a game. You're just going to, you know, when you should put the second string in, knowing that the over-under is 80 and you're only at 70, you leave the first string in a little longer. I mean, I don't see how that would be. I mean, if you were looking for somebody's an honest person to do it, you can't approach him with the idea that you're gonna rig the game, right? You're just gonna rig the bet. In my opinion,
yeah, that's the approach. But like I said, if you're the underdog, shaving points,
well, that's
a problem. By definition, also, it's also giving up the game.
Well, I mean, but as the underdog, say you're 20-point dogs in the second half. You could be putting, and you're down by 24, and the other team puts in their second string. You could put yours in, but you don't. You want to make up those 4 points.
I understand that, Tom, but that's not the deal you make when you start the game. That's not a deal you make during the, you know, on the fly during the game. That's a deal you make before the game, which says, I'm not going to win. I'm specifically not going to win. I'm going to lose by more than the spread.
Well, okay. Yeah, I mean it's definitely odd. So, what do you think? Are we going to get?
By the way, it is. Speaking of college basketball, there was a couple of other good upsets. You know, Virginia lost to Navy.
Really?
Which was unexpected. Yes. Today is National Signing Day. It's the big day for everybody. Hope springs eternal for every program today.
There's got to be, there has to be somebody like the Hey Jackass from Murders in Chicago. There's got to be somebody somewhere, maybe Beldo since he's not at the club anymore. You have to run a, there's got to be an internet site that tracks transfers. I'm going to say right now.
Oh, there is. Yeah, you can just go to verbalcommits.com. They have the whole transfer portal thing up.
No, I mean, there's got to be. Is there a record for somebody signing on a Tuesday and like transferring on a Thursday?
Well, that would be new. There are people who, when there's a coaching change, will try and back out of a letter of their commitment letter. But by and large, everybody who signs today is going to be there at their school for the next year.
For the next year. Okay, so you can't really wiggle
out.
And
then you see what happens. You take it from there. But, you're pretty well committed. There are some people who have been let out of their national letters of intent because the coach got fired.
This is football now today you're talking about.
To play for a certain coach, but that doesn't happen very often.
This is football now you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about basketball.
Okay, when's footballs?
Football's later. I think it's like February. I don't remember if they ever put in an early signing period in December, but I believe football's usually like the first weekend of February.
Right. So
first
this is
week of February.
This is people committing till next year. What if some kid graduates in December? Now can he? You still don't have that. Can he join the team?
It happens all the time. People graduate in December. They enroll in their college and go to spring football practice.
But it doesn't happen in basketball, though, where they're actually playing, does it?
It actually did last year. You don't see it very often, but for instance, just an example I know off the top of my head is Olivia Miles for the Notre Dame women's basketball team joined the team last January and was, it took her about 2 weeks to get acclimated. She's a really highly rated point guard. But the reason she did was because she was, in New Jersey or someplace like that, and the high school season got canceled. So she took the early graduation and went and started playing some basketball last year, and it didn't count against her eligibility. So she's now a freshman with about 15 games of experience under her belt.
Kevin, you went to Loyola, correct? I know that.
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine. I was in the honors program at Marist. I had no awareness at any time of where I was, and on like a national graduation shtick, for lack of a better term. I have to believe that by the time I was halfway through my senior year, in terms of math, sciences, and everything else, under most people's, whoever most people even are, idea, I probably could have graduated. Plus, I was not an athlete enough for anybody wanted me. But if I was, I can't imagine. Walking into the principal's name was Brother Sestaro. We called him Rock because he was looked like a Homo sapiens gorilla dude that you would not mess with. I can't imagine walking into his office like right before Christmas break and saying "See ya." I mean, you graduated in June. That's when you were. That's the program you're at. I don't know. The thought of somebody, even though quote, I probably had enough credits for lack of a better term. Of anybody leaving early, didn't even cross anybody's mind. How do you walk in and say "see" and then show up at Notre Dame a week later? I mean, it happens all the time now, but it seems odd to me. I mean, let's put it this way: it didn't happen in our generation, did it? That I know of.
No, it really didn't happen very much. I think I had one high school classmate who went away to college after 3 years. He had been to summer school every year and just got ahead. He was a really smart guy. And so he was off to college after 3. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of it. But somewhere along the line, they started doing it with football and said, if we have a really star freshman, we can get him through spring football. He'll have the practice under his belt, and maybe the guy will be ready to start in the fall. You started seeing, teams will have 3-4 of those guys all the time. Basketball, I don't think you're going to see it very much. It is just so hard. It's the same reason you don't get a lot of football players who play basketball anymore, because now with damn near half of the teams, if they're even mediocre, they're going to a bowl game. So you're with your team until the end of the calendar year, and so by by the time you get done with football and maybe take a week off to decompress a little bit, if you want to go play basketball, they're already into the conference season, and you're trying to work your way into the lineup, and the lineup's pretty well set. So, you know, I don't think you're going to see that very often. Maybe on a bad team, you know, maybe you'll get a situation like North Carolina had when Julius Peppers and what was the quarterback's name that played for them? I can't remember his name now. That they go play basketball because North Carolina football was really bad in those days. So
well, the idea of the
basketball,
but just the conditioning and everything.
Curry was the quarterback's name.
Well, you might get a D back or a receiver to be an outfielder or something in baseball, but other than
that, baseball works. Baseball can work because you can just you can practice when you can. And you can you can toggle back and forth between spring practice, which isn't every day, and baseball. So you get your Samardzijas or a Pat Connaughton, and you know, especially if you're a pitcher, you can go pitch, and that works for a lot of people. Golden Tate did that when he was an outfielder at Notre Dame. So you see that. You don't see it as really often, but you see Notre Dame just got a commitment from a big time linebacker recruit who's coming here because he likes the baseball program too, and so his choices were all the places who told him he could play baseball as well as football. He had Auburn on his list, and he had Mississippi or Mississippi State, one of those big time baseball schools. So two sports works depending on the two sports.
Well, I don't see how. I mean, even way back in our day, I remember going to see Quinn Buckner, who was he was in Indiana, and he played, safety on the football. He was from Thornridge, I think, Illinois.
Thornridge, yeah.
But I remember watching him play football. I mean, I was down there for a game. I went down with Flynn and those guys. We went to a game, and then 2 weeks later, I saw him play basketball, and he was easily 20 pounds too heavy for basketball. I mean, it took him... He had to be 6 weeks to get in what I would call basketball shape.
To get into full basketball condition, yeah.
And I remember...
Buckner, he was a great athlete, and in those days, Indiana wasn't going to a bowl game, so he could get released early as soon as the football season was over. He was ready to go play basketball.
Well, I don't know how the guy in our time... Manny, who's the guy who's ESPN forever? Mike Golic? Well, his older brother, Bob... is only one of two sport same year All-Americans at Notre Dame ever. I mean, they've had a lot of All-Americans. There's only been two guys who were two sport. And somehow or another, the dude would play middle linebacker on the football team, and like a week or two later, he's wrestling at like 25 pounds lighter. Because he wasn't a heavyweight. I think he was light heavy. I don't know how the hell you pull that off. But he was an All-American in football and wrestling the same year. I mean, and it would
probably made him a good nose tackle in the NFL,
which
too.
It did. Obviously,
he was a linebacker in college, but he was a nose man in the NFL. And being a wrestler is probably really good for the kinds of moves you need to free yourself.
I think he might have been on the stuff a little bit, but I don't know that. But I'm saying it's pretty hard to do. SB Futures down 950. Kevin, talk at you Friday. NASDAQ Futures down 72. Be right back, Mr. Hal Snar, Professor Hal Snar.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
Lower Rope Bay, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Alley. He's Mr. over the board. SP Futures down 10. NASDAQ Futures down 68. We were down yesterday, and we're threatening to be down again today. But we still have a lot of buy the dippers out there and a lot of money around. So I wouldn't be surprised if we came back today. Professor, how are you?
Good morning.
What's a good word? How's the? You guys got snow out there? You skiing yet? What are you doing?
The mountains are white, but the valleys aren't too bad. They're just a little wet. So it's getting cold. I got to start wearing my parka now.
You got one of those new ones with the moose on there or whatever there?
Parkas? I got a cheap one from Amazon.
Oh, what's the one where they busted into the, they drove cars through the windows twice at the place by me to buy the, was it the moose heads, maybe? Where else?
And those are the wild goose. I think that's what they're called.
Yeah.
If it has anything to do with fashion, my fashion is about as, mine's an equivalent to yours, so.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't buy anything new.
Well, we could get the little insignia and sew them on there, like, you know, people used to do.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
People used to.
Yeah, but then you're just kind of fronting, aren't you?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, plus you let yourself open to be mugged, too.
And to be accurate, they're called Canada Goose.
Canada Goose.
Not Wild Goose. Canada Goose.
Well, that's the difference.
Those are the big brand, or have been the last couple of years. I don't know if they're still popular.
A lot of the ladies, they were having people being mugged and shucked off their backs here. I don't think they want one anymore.
Well, that's because they those coats start at like $600 and go up well above that.
Really?
I got four kids to feed, so I'm not going to be buying anything like that.
Well, how old are the triplets? Last week we were having
the
a debate.
Triplets, triplets are in second grade. They're 7 years old. And then my son, Joe, who has a size 14 foot, he's 12.
Good Lord.
Yeah, he's 12 and he has a size 14 foot, so I think he's going to be a tall one.
I would say so.
Are you sure you're the father and not Bob Lanier, for God's sake?
What's that?
Are you sure you're the father and not Bob Lanier?
I don't know. Well, his uncles have long arms and legs, and I got the Nordic torso, so I think when you combine all it together, he's going to be a tall kid.
Oh, good. Oh, that's cool. What was Bob, 23? Bob Lanier, man, or some huge story? Was 23 size foot or something?
Something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's wow. Well, you know.
Jeez.
I mean, I know.
Feet on those feet.
Yeah, what do you got? You put two pairs of shoes together. Hey, I was thinking today was interesting. I read your conclusion because I want to talk more about what you guys are doing because we've been beating up a lot of subjects here together. And
yeah.
I just want to kind of go through when you – I was reading this thing about the minimum wage – and whether it helps or hurts or whatever. And I guess when you look at my first question, I'm always questioning stuff. That's why I don't know, it makes me nuts, I guess. But when you start looking at minimum wage, it would seem to me that not all minimum wages are equal. I mean, if the market wage for a certain level, say that, you know, that base level of an employee, lack of a better term, is $10, and your minimum wage is $8, and the politicians run around like a bunch of peacocks and raise it to $9, well, you haven't done anything, really.
Yeah, you haven't. That's why I think most times when the federal government raises the minimum wage, they typically do it during expansions when there's no damage.
Yeah.
When Austrians call it the marginal pairs are near the market rate, whether it's a price or a wage. And the marginal payers are the marginal businesses or the marginal consumers. And when you impose a binding minimum wage, if it's not much different than the market wage, there's little damage to those marginal payers. But if you set it at a really extremely high level, which may not be a high level like, say, in New York, but in Wyoming or in Samoa, when you impose a minimum wage that is much higher than the market wage, then you increase the number of marginal payers. And for example, when they do, I have a senator from Samoa, and he knows about this, but when the federal government extended its minimum wage rate into Samoa back, 2008-ish, when they jacked it up to 715 or 725, I forget the exact answer or the exact rate, but when they jacked it up to its current level, it actually caused one of the tuna companies to go out of business. There were two of them there. So the marginal firm went out of business in Samoa and kept, and Starkist benefited from that, right? Because it had one less competitor, right, in that labor market. So it caused all kinds of unemployment in Samoa. And the same thing happens in Wyoming, right? If you impose a $15 minimum wage, San Francisco is going to go, all right, that's cool. New York's going to go, that's cool, right? Because that's what their market wages are for low-skilled workers. But in Wyoming, man, when you impose that $15 minimum wage in Wyoming, you're going to do some serious damage. You're going to lose a lot of those marginal firms. The big firms, the low-cost firms like Walmart and Amazon, they're going to do just fine. But you're going to eliminate all those mom-and-pa marginal firms who don't have the cost structure to support a $15 minimum wage. And they don't have the ability to automate it around it like McDonald's does.
It's funny how you almost can't have even a simple discussion today on anything, even the pure economics you're talking about, without wandering into politics. Isn't there some issue on American Samoa that Nancy Pelosi's husband is a big investor in the Starkist plant there or something, and they wanted the other one out of business?
You know, that came up last night in my MBA class. I teach a Tuesday night class that looks at entrepreneurship through the lens of neoclassical models that I reinterpret with Austrian principles. And I had a really big insight last night. We were discussing the effect of how to address externalities like cigarette smoking or CO2. And in the discussion, I'm like, well, if Philip Morris is the established, low-cost, non-innovative producer of cigarettes, what does this huge tax on them, on cigarette manufacturers, do to the marginal firms, to their competitors? And neoclassical models can't address this. They don't address this, right? Because they just talk about it in generic terms, right? But if you interpret these neoclassical models with Austrian principles, those marginal payers are eliminated. The boutique cigarette company that has higher cost structures because it doesn't have economies of scale, those companies are eliminated. The marginally addicted smokers are eliminated. The heavily addicted smokers aren't eliminated. Philip Morris is probably okay with this because its customers are heavily addicted, and so it has no short-run effect on the health of its customers because they're heavily addicted. Although we kind of dipped into this a little bit further. I go, yep, it raises the cost on their addiction, so maybe they substitute away from healthier foods, and instead of eating a salad with grilled chicken, maybe they're eating top ramen, so it does have a negative effect on their health. So these interventions, they are probably okay for the big established low-cost firms, maybe Nancy Pelosi's husband's
companies. I think they followed up a little.
The marginal firms that are eliminated from the marketplace and the marginal consumers, they are wiped out. And neoclassical economists call that dead weight loss. But I think it kind of clouds over what's really going on, right? It's a competition eliminator.
Well, that's
these
right.
Interventions are competition eliminators.
Well, you look at the, by the way, I think that was followed up. And again, I'm not all over this one, but
yeah.
I think in the last round of raising the federal minimum wage, I think Samoa was carved out as not having to go up because now they're the only plant.
Yeah.
So But you know, it's funny if you and I. I mean, I love talking to you because this is the theory that I miss from not being in school anymore. But I've gotten so cynical. I'm like the Rodney Dangerfield in your classroom. You know, you got to pay this guy off. You got to pay that guy off.
Did you do the triple Lindy jump?
No,
diving board.
You know, I tell you what, diving and me were never much together. The thought of going head first off a high dive, that would not be me. just saying. But no, we don't have to worry about me diving and a few other sports that you couldn't get me doing the high hurdles, you know, anything like that. I mean, there's a few that I just said, eh. But
I'll walk around the hurdle. I won't go over it. Yeah. I'll walk
Plus
around
I couldn't even imagine how I could get over the damn thing. I couldn't, you know. Anyway, but a lot, you're right. A lot of what is happening, I mean, and you know, hey, you know, I'm going to ask you something. I know you know the answer. Who invented the term economic externality in one of the classic original stories or economic analysis of an economic externality and pollution and everything you just talked about? And you know, the guy just died not that long ago. And that thing was old when I was in school. The dude made it to like 100. He was at the University of Chicago. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I it's been a while since I taught any microeconomic theory. So I forgot the name. But I think the negative externality argument just gives politicians a license to intervene in the economy. I think if you look at CO2 emissions over the last 15 years, they're on a downward trajectory in the United States. And they continue on the same trajectory even after Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord. And the reason why that is, I tell my students this all the time, the reason why that is because young people want vehicles that are more friendly to the environment. And so firms are just satisfying that demand. And when old guys like you and I, Tom, pass away, what's going to be left are young people who are now in their 40s and 50s, and even younger people, and the new generation of young people, they're going to be demanding these products that are just cleaner.
But whether you
and so the markets are adjusting. Firms are adjusting. It's not government dictates are pushing this. It's as these younger kids get older and older and older, they want cleaner burning fuel vehicles, right? So entrepreneurs are just sensitive to that, and they're trying to satisfy that demand.
Yeah, but even you and I, we may be dinosaurs in some ways, but even we, I mean, we can't, nor would we want to. I don't want to go buy my 65 Olds again with the 425.
Yeah,
getting 10 miles at a gallon and having to stop every two blocks to fill up the gas and the oil. I don't want that. I mean,
I don't either. Yeah.
So today's car, it gets, you know, 20 something. Every time somebody buys a new car and turns in the old one, you're using less, right?
And
that should.
So I think even our generation is worried about it too, right? So none of us want to. I mean, in Utah, in Idaho, you'll see a 68 Ford pickup truck that gets 5 miles a gallon, right? But for the most part, I think most people in Utah, in Idaho, they're driving in moderately new cars that get pretty good gas mileage.
Well, plus, what's odd to me, Hal, is that I've been a house remodeler and dabbler my whole life because I enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. And I actually would love to design a couple of homes, you know, before I go. It's kind of on my bucket list and have them built. You know what I'd like to do, honestly, to talk about off topic? I'd like to design and build. I mean, say what I want. I couldn't design a damn thing. You wouldn't want architecture with me to ceiling and fall on your head. I'd like to build a home, kind of a ranch-style home, that was totally, and people are going to say, what's the story with the... That is totally handicapped ready, because you know what? Even people that are great athletes, tear a ligament playing basketball and are handicapped for a few weeks, right? Until it heals.
Yeah.
I would like to design a home that was totally designed where all the doors were 36 inches, all the showers, you could bring a wheelchair and stuff in. And I'd like to do it in such a way where nobody ever noticed it.
Yeah,
and I bet you could do that. And I bet if I built one,
I'd like to do is throw in a self-cleaning bathroom. That's what I'd love to do. You know, four kids, man, and two 7-year-old boys, man, they're creative in their relieving of themselves. Let's just say it that
way.
I'd like to add the self-cleaning bathroom.
Well, you might add an automatic wash for 7-year-olds like you do a car. Just walk them through.
It's like a closet, right? Yeah, a car
just
wash.
Walk in there. Well, you just stuff them in there. Almost the 15 different nozzles come out and spray the hell out of them, and they walk out clean. You know?
they walk from the bedroom into our bedroom to get dressed for school. As my wife, she does it one at a time. It's like an assembly line. It's pretty impressive. But yeah, as they walk into our bedroom, they wash. Like a car wash. That'd be awesome.
I
my wife wouldn't have as much fun, right? Because she puts them in a tub and they sing songs, and the two boys will swim around in the water like they're fish. So I think it would probably
be
fun.
It's
more efficient.
Yeah, but I'm saying even you, you look at and you live in a place where it can get pretty darn cold. But you look at a place, and I just spent all weekend. I mean, I live in a 100-year-old building, right? So everything you do, there's a leak here, a leak there. You know what I think I'm going to go out and buy if I can find one to figure out how to use it? I'm going to get a really nice infrared camera.
Oh.
So I can look and see, you know, where the, you know, heat's coming out of places. But I would say that as much of the lip flapping we do regarding gasoline and cars, because people buy it every week and it's right in front of them, but it gets, I'm going to say most people piss away way more energy in their house than they do in their car.
Oh, and it's even worse in New York. I mean, when I go around New York City, I'm thinking, wait a minute. I don't think this is a high priority for people, because people in New York City, they'll have their air conditioner, their room air conditioner, the window air conditioner, they leave it there year-round.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the cold air just flies in the winter between the air conditioner and the window moldings. And I'm like thinking, all right, maybe the pricing that government's doing with regard to energy prices, people don't really think energy prices are all that high. They're lower than what maybe the market would dictate, and they leave their air conditioners in.
Well, I think a lot of...
You go to Brooklyn College, Tom, every office that leaves their window air conditioner in the window year-round.
I'm going to bet you that the building provides the heat.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
So, but I read something, Hal, if I could find it, I'd send it to you, but I don't know where the hell it is, because I don't think they ever did the job, but this had to be 10 years ago, and, well, what's it, the Willis Tower now, man? It was a Sears Tower. Massive building. Not just high, it's massive. You know, it's a full square block, or maybe two blocks, and, you know, it had how many people, you know, worked in the damn place, unbelievable, but the thing was built in, I'm going to say, 72, 71, somewhere in there. And I think all the windows are like single pane, and, you know, there's all these issues with it. So somebody, it was a Chicago magazine or whatever, writes this thing, and me, of course, being the dummy that I am, I read it. And it has to do with if you totally retrofitted the place with the latest double pane windows, and some way you can buy windows now that even when the sun hits them at a certain angle, the windows darken up, so don't let it in and heat the place up and the air conditioning, whatever. There's a lot of really incredible stuff on the market now.
Oh, yeah, I worked at a glass plant in Michigan right after I got the Navy, and we had a machine that coated glass, you know, big sheets of architectural glass. It coated it with, it was called a low-E coater, and it traps heat in during the winter, and then it's designed in an interesting way that keeps the heat in the building. So you install these in skyscrapers in northern climates to trap the heat in. So you don't have to spend as much money heating the place as you would otherwise. That's pretty impressive, and that's been around since.
Yeah,
I worked there in the 1990s.
I'm saying this is not a new article, and they were talking about there's all these flat areas where one tower stops and the other one keeps going. That if you put even three or four of those, not the you know the dumb Dutch windmills where you get the big things spinning around, but the ones that look like a globe and they just spin. So if you put two or three of those up there, there's always wind up there.
Yeah.
And if you put a couple, that somehow or another, the bottom line was an estimate of something like 5,000 houses or some incredible amount of the space on the that is exposed to like a day that's 10 below zero and how much you lose. It's something was mind boggling to the point where I'm thinking it can't be that much. I mean, I'm sitting there doing the math. Really? 5,000 houses or 1,000 houses? Whatever. But it's astounding what we can do in the energy area if we want to. And it's not just telling your neighbor to get a different car.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because people like pointing for fingers at other people, but, I mean, like, there, I mean, I would say the housing stock in this country, there's cities, I drove through Buffalo once, the housing stock there's gotta be 150 years old. I bet every single house, if you wanted to, with insulation and stuff, you could cut their energy use in half.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is the cities where these issues are really important, they have building codes that prevent, that make it really expensive to update your home. So in places like San Francisco, they have these anti-development laws, or these, like in New York City, if you live in a historic brownstone, you need a special kind of contractor. There's a limited supply of them, so they're really expensive. So what ends up happening is these old homes in these cities that claim that they're pro-environment, it makes it really difficult for people, really expensive for people to upgrade their homes. But you get in rural areas like Idaho and Utah, every brand new home has the best insulation, it has central air, there's no window air conditioners, and so I find that kind of ironic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, what you mentioned earlier, and I would love to see, I don't know how you could do it as a, but I think, you know, as we move, and we've talked before about the movement in this country towards, you called it a Nazi economic system where, Lou calls it a fascist system where there's a few businesses. I'm going to say that the idea about how people react to laws, I'm going to say that the regulation in our business, in the securities business, dramatically more on a dollar for dollar basis hits on small firms and big firms, to the point where that's why the big firms keep getting bigger. They keep buying small firms out because they can't. Even
well,
if
they also have the legal teams to, they have the economies of scale in terms of navigating it, right?
Well, you have to, this will go nowhere. I'll be as light with this as I can. There was a friend of mine, of course, I haven't seen him in 2 years to COVID, but pointed out a lady who was hired one night by one of the big banks who used to work at the Fed, who evidently got fired from the Fed. And he says, how the hell the lady gets fired from the Fed? You can only imagine. Anyway.
Yeah, that'd be pretty bad, because I think it's pretty difficult probably to get fired from
a
pseudo-government agency,
but immediately,
right?
Immediately gets snapped up by a bank. So also, in addition to whatever the game is, you're supposed to be a place where somebody from FINRA or somebody from the banking regulators, the game is for you to hire this person for like a whole bunch of money, and the only job is to play with the regulators when they show up. So that's where you get the,
or maybe feed the bank information about what might the Fed announce in their next meeting, right?
Well, one of the
That's a whole nother.
But I'm saying is, one of the guys who worked for Arthur Levitt, and I forget his name, so I can tell the story. He was their second in command at the SEC, and he somehow, I don't know, he got in dodge about something. I don't know what happened, but he ended up going to and Bear Stearns had some issue. This is before they went under, and he ended up being he became the new compliance guy at Bear Stearns.
Mm.
And a lot of Bear Stearns' problems miraculously went away because he played the game. He hired the, but there's a lot of this going on. And I don't know how you quantify it, how you look at a securities firm with 50 people and say, okay, their regulatory compliance stuff, if they have to hire somebody high enough just to play with these people, that their compliance costs are, you know, 30% of their revenue, or, you know, for Schwab, it's 10% of their revenue, even though they got, because they just say they have enough for full-time people, they have enough to... Well, you know, I think that's burying a lot of industries. I mean, it's burying ours, for sure.
I mean, it's not uncommon in other industries. Like, if you look at the BP oil spill in the Gulf, right? Wasn't it kind of an industry insider that was hired to inspect these oil rigs, right?
Something like that, yeah. I don't remember
the story. Yeah, a revolving door between the regulator and the industry. I think it's pretty common, actually.
Well, but there's always... Plus, there's this incredible idea that when you're doing things that are risky and dangerous like that, that somehow or another, if you just would have had more regulation, and paid more in fees and licenses, somehow it wouldn't happen. Well, guess what?
You know, the funny thing about that, though, is because of the Exxon Valdez incident, right, the federal government was telling oil companies drilling in the Gulf to not do it so close to the shore, do it in deeper waters where it's more risky.
Yeah.
And then they also limited the amount of liability that a company that had a spill in the Gulf would have to pay. I think it was like capped or something in exchange for pushing their drilling out in deeper waters where it's riskier and more expensive. The government artificially lowered the fine it would impose if there was a spill.
Well, but if you have an oil spill, say it's the same size oil spill, and you have it in the middle of the Gulf, there's organisms that eat oil. It never makes it to shore.
Yeah. That's the reason why everybody's predicting doom and gloom on the eastern seaboard, right? And it never happened.
Well, right. What I'm saying is that also if it's out, I mean, there were oil spills in the ocean before there were people.
Yeah. Well, you know, did you know this? The number one source of carbon pollution in terms of CO2 carbon, you know, it's natural seepage in the Pacific Ocean. Natural seepage. That's the number one pollutant in terms of like carbon-based fuels. It's natural seepage. The oil pressure is so great in these underground pools under the ocean floor that it pushes through the crust and seeps into the ocean.
Well, wow, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean it's like the methane that ends up in the water table, right?
But
people blame fracking for it. But places in Michigan, when I lived in Michigan as a float glass plant mechanic back in the 1990s after I got out of the Navy, I remember my friends telling me that when they were kids, they'd bring over their friends from out of state and they would show them how the water would light on fire. And this was before fracking.
Wow.
It's just natural seepage from these underground pools of natural gas or crude oil or whatever. It seeps into the oil table and the water catches on fire.
We can go to break here in a sec, but I want to ask you, you're doing some good work, politicians are doing whatever the hell they're doing. I want to ask you, what was so unique in the early 70s, which created a lot of the competition out of non-competition? There was a huge, almost a marriage between people in politics and people at universities, especially economics professors, and the market got an awful lot freer for a while. I don't sense any real connection between the work people like you are doing and what our people in Washington are doing anymore. I mean, is there... Let's talk about that after break. SP Futures on 17, NASDAQ Futures down 104. We should be able to... the CPI number, here we go. Here we go, Hal. 0.9%. I wonder. We come back. Let's talk about that, because there's a couple of trades I don't think I've told you about that are interesting. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and try to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment.
Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Matt Weber on the board. S&P futures now down 14. They were down more than that when the CPI number came out, but they've bounced back some. NASDAQ futures down 99, and we have the Dow futures still only down 34. I don't think this one is a is reacting quick. I'll give you that one in a second. We're in Europe, we've got the my machine. I've got all so much stuff up here. DAX down 6. Call that flat. FTSE up 47.6. CAC around down 16.2. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 178. 0.6%. Shanghai down 14.4. Hang Seng up 183.7. Again, yesterday we were down. Dow was down 112. S&P down 16. NASDAQ down 95. So down, but not very much. Bonds up. They're now back up to 1.49 with the CPI number. I said it's bonds. That's a 10-year rate. The bond minus 0.28 and Japan minus positive 0.05. We've got oil down 33 cents, 83.82. Brent down 12 cents, 84.66. Natural gas down 14, 4.83, under $5 now. Hal was smart enough to have, sell at 6.09, buy at 4.99, sell at 6. Well, that's, you didn't have to teach anymore. Our Bob down a penny, 2.36. We've got gold down a buck, 18.29 was down more than that. Silver down 10 cents, 24.21. Copper down 2 cents at 4.35. And we have Bitcoin down 2.49, but still way up there, 66,880. And again, consumer price index, 6.2% in October, but I think it's worse than that. I'll get the full numbers here in a second. Go ahead, Manny. Matt, good traffic, weather, sports.
Sure, 35 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. We have a crash on the Stevenson right now. This is on the inbound side right at Cermak Road as you're approaching the circle. So that's causing some delays on I-55 as you're heading into downtown. That's our first crash on the expressways this morning after we've been off to a pretty good start. No issues on the outbound side. Normal traffic volumes down there. But we also have a crash to the south. I-57 on the northbound side at Sibley Boulevard, which is right at 147th Street. That crash is blocking the left shoulder and is causing some stop-and-go traffic heading inbound on I-57. Bishop Ford looks okay. No issues on the Eisenhower at this hour, which is good. Same for the Edens and Kennedy, though traffic is building steadily. Off the expressways, there's a crash out west, Butterfield Road at Stratford Avenue. And then just west of there, there's an accident. It's actually a road construction situation, not an accident, that has St. Charles Road closed due to traffic signal replacement crews on the scene there between Grace and Main Street. This is in Lombard, western suburbs. Everything else looking good out there. Weather today, partly cloudy skies, cool temperatures, a high of 56, which is right around normal for this time of year. Right now it's overcast and 52 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 84 today. Right now it's clear and 58. In sports, Blackhawks have won 2 in a row. They topped the Penguins in a shootout 3-2 last night. Bulls were off. They'll host the Mavericks tonight at the UC. That's a 7 p.m. tip-off. Phoenix Suns were off as well. They'll host the Blazers tonight. That's 7 p.m. Arizona time start. College hoops got underway last night, tipping off the 2021-22 season. Number 11 Illinois beat up on Jackson State 71-47. Northwestern no problem with Eastern Illinois 80-56. Loyola crushed Coppin State 103-45. And then Western Illinois upset Nebraska 75-74. And Northern Illinois upset Washington 71-64. Chief.
This number here is I was mentioning yesterday we had with Jeff, and I don't know if he was into it as much as I was, but if you want to be a real pick a bad term about somebody,
to the people who are on the Fed right now, Al, all you'd have to do, and Maddie could do this because he's good at this kind of stuff, is to go back for like the last 12 announcements from the Fed. I think you wouldn't have to go more than 12, maybe 15. Man, we can't even get this inflation up to 2%, but it's still 1%. We have no idea how to, we just keep, you know, it's stubborn, it doesn't even want to move. Nowhere in the foreseeable future are we talking about inflation. That would have been like 13, 14 months ago. Well, it's getting close to 2, but we don't mind overreaching a little bit. Here we are a year later, and these bumps are admitting now to 6.2 year over year. Hell, that didn't start last month. It happened when these guys were talking about there wasn't any.
Yeah.
I mean, what are we paying these guys for? Where are we getting them? They're not, obviously not coming out of your class.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look at a lot of the economics departments in the Northeast, and I don't really know if there's a lot of economic diversity, economic thought diversity in a lot of these departments. I mean, I don't think I'd have a chance of getting a job in the Northeast because I think Murray and Hayek and Milton made great arguments against a lot of this monetary and fiscal nonsense. I don't think you can change tax rates. I don't think you should constantly cut tax rates and raise tax rates to stimulate the economy in a Keynesian sense, because when you constantly do that kind of stuff, it makes it difficult for firms to plan for 20 or 30 years. So this argument that in a recession we cut taxes and then during the expansion we raise the taxes to pay for the deficits we ran during the recession, to me that's all nonsense because firms can't plan for 20, 30 years. That's one reason why business is booming in Utah, because they basically set tax rates low, and they just fixed them. They haven't adjusted them like in 15 to 20 years. So firms can plan for 20 years here. But when you're constantly raising and lowering taxes, you're making it difficult for firms to plan. And then on top of that, you have the central planner. They find it easy to lower interest rates, but man, when those things are low, you know, they really hesitate in raising them. And I just don't think traders, whether they're buying stocks or bonds, I don't think traders believe the Fed is going to taper. Because you saw, maybe for a few hours, bond prices and stock prices going up together for a little while, but man, a few hours later, I think people realized that, you know, the Fed is not going to taper, and, you know, prices of bonds went up, the 30-year went up, as the S&P 500 went up. So I just don't think investors believe anything the Fed is saying.
Well, the thing that I believe, and I predicted, God, it had to be 5 years ago, I can't believe that these guys are going to let me be right here. They're only going to change when they're in deep bleep, and they're getting in deep bleep. If we get the number this month was 0.9%.
Yeah.
If we get 3 or 4 months in a row of 1%, which I think could really be coming, all of a sudden you're going to see the outrage. It's going to be the entire reason that the midterm elections go the way they go.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the number one thing in this country, and you're going to end up, the Fed will be out of control. They'll put somebody in there like a Volcker, and he's going to start raising this stuff by a percent a month, and we're going to be in deep trouble. And
yeah, you know, the funny thing is, the Milton Friedman, Edmund S. Phelps, augmented Phillips curve, that is the one macroeconomic idea that seems to work or worked really well in the early 1980s. You restrict money growth to increase interest rates to induce high unemployment to cure the inflation that the central bank had caused previously. That is the one macroeconomic model that seems to work.
Except
all the other macroeconomic models, in my opinion, are ways that young PhDs can get on the staff of either a Republican or Democrat congressperson or senator, right? They skew their research in a way that says what Republicans do is great, or what Democrats do is great. And that's what I think we have here. We don't have independence between economists and politicians.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I don't know if you were on in the last, anyway, I was talking about
it
this.
It might have been a month ago.
This trade that somebody did, there were a couple of very unusual trades in the VIX, Hal, and one of them was a guy bought all these November calls and sold October calls, where it was very timing specific, which you don't normally see, and matter of fact, you very rarely see, to the point where whoever did it was expecting some event in November. And then somebody 2 days later bought something like 90,000 of the 20 calls in the VIX for November. Now those have gone down. He paid $5 and was essentially a $45 million trade, the size of which I don't think I've ever seen in the options market ever. And he's been wrong. The VIX has come down in the last couple of days. It's been creeping back up. I'm anxious to see where it opens today, because I actually have a spread on in there. So if it goes up, it'll be good for my people. But one of the things that I was wondering, why would anybody think that? Because I don't think that these CPI numbers, one of these days, I'd like to talk for a full half hour, really, on what you just talked about. Because I'm going to say that the way Volcker did that, in retrospect, was absolutely wrong. And the reason why I'm going to say that is because of the way the CPI has such a lagging influence to it. I think he could have taken his foot off the brake.
I think what he did is he kept interest rates artificially high.
Yeah.
And I think he kept them there maybe too long. And I think it's because of the politics, right? He's a Democrat. He was appointed by Carter. And I think having interest rates high for an extended period of time, and a lot of conservative economists don't like Volcker for this reason.
I don't think he was, I don't know about that. Yeah. Hal. I think he was promoted to the chairman. But I think he was appointed by Nixon, wasn't he?
Well, maybe, yeah. I think, it's been a while since I looked at this, but I thought he was appointed to the position of the chair under the Carter administration because he needed to get inflation under control.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't remember who appointed him to the chair.
I think Volcker was pretty apolitical.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the conservative economists that I've talked to, they don't like Volcker because he made Reagan look bad because the high interest rates made the deficit look worse than it would have been otherwise, right? So that's why a lot of conservative economists that I've spoken to don't like Volcker.
I think
the interest rates had to be driven up and unemployment had to go high to cure this inflation. So I think his actions initially killed what could have been a hyperinflation cycle. And we had to endure a couple years of high unemployment,
so you know what?
And recession to cure that.
I have a peculiar interest in that era because I was the inflation guy at Pullman, and I was at I had classes with Milton Friedman, and it's all they talked about, right? So I mean, it was worse than me. That's all we talked about.
And I can imagine.
Yeah. Oh God, you can imagine the Monetarist School in 1975, the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about you couldn't go from class to class before.
Well, none of that action would have been necessary if they weren't experimenting with Keynesianism in the 1960s and the price controls and Ed Burns, telling people that he's a Friedmanite when he really isn't, right?
No, he wasn't.
You become the Fed chair, you want to stimulate the economy. You want the economy to boom under your watch. So Ed Burns may have been telling people that he agrees with Milton Friedman, but he did not govern.
No,
in that way.
They started increasing the money supply during the Vietnam War to pay for the war.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the same thing we're doing now. But anyway, with this particular trade, to kind of get back to it, one of the things I suspected, Hal, is if you look at, I'm looking right at the CPI, the actual publication here, and I'm looking at owner's equivalent rent of residence, which is their idea of your cost of home ownership, correct?
Which is very subjective in that CPI.
Well, okay, now I'm going to say, what would you say? Where's my significant other Audrey when I need her? I'm going to say the price of new homes in general are up somewhere between 15% and 25% in the last 18 months, 2 years. Am I wrong?
Well, I think it depends on where you live too. In Utah, it is unbelievable here. It is. I think we could sell our condo, which we bought for $225,000. I bet we could sell our condo for $500,000 now.
Okay,
and we bought it when the triplets were born.
All right. So what I'm saying is, according to these guys, it's only up 3.1% in the
last
year.
Yeah, that's a bogus number. So that's the problem with the CPI is if you like the current president, you can doctor the value of housing in a way that keeps the CPI from being reflective of reality. But if you don't like the current occupant of the White House, you can overstate it. That housing component of the CPI is very subjective. And if it's only up 3%, I'm sorry, I don't buy it at all.
Well, the weird part is, I think, from memory, that yesterday, if you'd have looked at it, it was up 2.3. Mm-hmm. So it's actually made a reasonable jump this month. So anyway.
Well, I think the people who are imputing that number, they're going to get called out for being a liar, because if you look at the 20 city or the national Case-Shiller home price index, it is a vertical line, dude.
Oh, yeah.
It's a vertical line.
I'm with you. Yeah, but
there's no way it's 2%.
Yeah, but when you say you're going to get called out, these bumps, I mean, individually they're probably fine people, have had medical care services as 7% of your basket for 15 years. I've been looking at this. And it's been 20% of the economy for the same 15 years. So they never get called out, Harold. I mean, when I say no, I'm saying it's 20% of the economy is medical care.
There has to be some kind of they know that 2% isn't reality, right? They know that it's not.
But the question is, and this is what I want to ask you on a technical level, because when I was talking with Kevin earlier, as much as I complain about the CPI, I wouldn't want that job.
Yeah.
Because doing it correctly and having it match up with stuff 20 years ago is really a thankless task. But the question is, why did these people buy all this VIX stuff in November? Now, one of my thoughts was that the people that do the CPI, when they know they're really off on one, they make an adjustment in the current month. And one of the thoughts I had was that maybe they were going to make the housing adjustment in November, and somebody knew that, so they bought the VIX for November. Now, they've made somewhat of an adjustment here, but not very much of one. Now, the question is, what else is somebody looking at here? Because, I mean, they didn't even, if we're up to 0.9% still lying like this about, well, another one down on the bottom, this will get you, even though they made an adjustment this month. According to these guys, they have the cost of health insurance down 6.5% year over year. In what planet could that possibly correct that your cost of your health insurance went down?
Well, I mean, you got to remember it's expenditures, right?
No, this is the cost of...
Maybe people...
No, this is health insurance.
Maybe people are expecting expenditures to decline because of staffing shortages, right? People are just not going to be able to go... to the hospital because they have these staffing issues.
They got medical care services.
Is going to drop.
Medical care services up 1.7%, and they've got price of health insurance is down 6.4%. I'm going to say if we could ever get a straight answer out of Northwestern or Rush or any of the people here and say, okay, what's the cost of a room today versus a year ago? I'm going to doubt very seriously it's only up 1.7%.
Well, isn't that component, though, more about what people are spending in total? Right?
No, it is. It's supposed to be the price of services. That's what it is.
Yeah.
But I mean, I haven't asked my brother, but I mean, if we're paying insurance for 10 people here at PTI like we used to, do you think it would be down on the year? I can't imagine that. Maybe if we upped everybody's, and this is what I'm trying to get at when you do your studies. Because when you do stuff and ask people to do stuff for you, I think you design it in such a way where you want the proper answer, but how do you do it? If you have if you have somebody that's not Rodney Dangerfield in the class, you could do a huge study of medical insurance purchased by PTI Securities and say, wow, in the last 10 years it's done this, and in the last 3 years it hasn't gone up very much. But unless your guy or girl is smart enough to ask the next question and said, well, wait a minute, are the deductibles going up and that's why you're keeping the number even? Well, if the answer to that is yes, well, then you have to somehow impute a raise, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's kind of interesting because I read an article about the time the Affordable Care Act was being rolled out, and it was about Blue Cross Blue Shield in Texas, that when they would receive calls from people asking questions about in-network, what kind of services are covered, really detailed questions. What that signals to the person on the other end of the phone call is that this person is a person who consumes insurance a lot. And then you have the other people calling saying, hey, I just need to meet the government mandate. What's your lowest cost, highest deductible insurance policy? I want to buy it. What that did is it sorted people according to how much they use health insurance. So Blue Cross Blue Shield was insuring the people that asked very few questions and were wanting to purchase low-cost, high-deductible policies. So I think you have a point there, right? It could be the case that maybe the policies that are being purchased in aggregate, they tend to be the ones that have low premium, high deductible, and catastrophic coverage. Well, right.
Which is,
and if they're not accounting for that in the CPI, you would see that number not grow as fast as it is actually, right?
Well, I haven't looked at it that much lately, Hal. When it first came out, I mean, we did, maybe remember, we probably ad nauseum to him because I went through the Obamacare, you know, not like an expert or anything like that, but I just went through the different plans, and it struck me, I mean, as you know, my shtick, which drives me nuts as a person, I always want to ask the next question, you know, because you can't just do one thing, right? I mean, you know that in your research. I mean, one of the plans, I'm going to say what, the Brands plan, I seem to remember the number, the key number was $50,000. If you made over 50, it was pretty much all on you. If you're under 50, you started getting help. All right, but the Brands plan, I think at the time, and Maddie's got a better memory than me, for a family of four, because I know some of my buddies in the building here that are like, I use the term engineers, janitors, whatever you want to call it. They run the place and clean it and do everything else. And I'm gonna, those guys, and I always talk to them and they're good friends. The plan would be, was like $1,350 a month for a family of four. So you and your wife, son and daughter, you know, but I think the deductible per family was like $13,000. Which is a real number if you're making $52,000 a year. I mean, for God's sake. You know, so you end up in a routine where I don't even think you have insurance, to an extent where, I mean, if your son or daughter, you know, gets a concussion or tears up an ankle playing soccer or whatever, I think you're probably still going to county hospital. You can't pay that bill on its own. And these insurance companies, I remember we had one of those HSA plans or something where you put the money in the bank and it stayed there. It was like another IRA, and it was you could deduct and put in a bank account your insurance, you know, your, in case anything ever happened to you, that would be your deductible. You pull it out of there. I'm sure they still have those things.
Yeah, we have one.
And so I was pretty damn healthy, so I got like $15,000 in there. Which is like, you know, real dough. I mean, for something like that. And I figured, well, hell, I mean, this is going swimmingly, right? Well, all of a sudden, like in the next 3 years, and my deductible was $5,000. Mm. Well, in the next 3 years, I, you know, fortunately didn't have any real health issues, but I had, you know, like a health scare, you know, where they'd say, oh man, where your doctor would send you to a specialist and then he would say, you got to go to an MRI on this. And I did. And fortunately, all three times, you know, I was okay. It was nothing wrong. I mean, thank God. But the weird part of it now, every single trip to the specialist and the MRI was just under $5,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not like I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, this can't be a random event. So in 3 years, my whole $15,000 is now pissed away.
Well, you know, I had the same experience in North Carolina. I had issues with getting blocked up. And I went in to see a GI doctor, right, gastrointestinal doctor, and they charged me $80 for the copay, and then they billed my insurance company like $350. And I'm thinking to myself, the guy that I talked to, I think if it wasn't for insurance, the most I'd be willing to pay was probably $80 for the visit.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
But the office was able to get nearly $500 out of me and the insurance company.
Oh, sure.
Right?
The overhead is spectacular. Sure. Those guys make more than the doctor. Now, the people that run these, you know, whatever, what do they call them, the concierge medicine and all stuff, the executives make way more than the doctor.
Yeah.
But so what do you make of these numbers starting to percolate up here? What do you, is this guy going to be reappointed or what, Paul? I mean, are they going to blame it on him? What's going to happen here?
Man, I don't know. I just don't think anybody believes that he's going to taper anytime soon. And if he does taper, I think he'll probably end up losing his job because he's going to make it's going to end this meager recovery that we have in, you know, the blue states. We have a robust economy in Utah. I mean, I think I told you last time.
Well, you got people moving there.
It's like 2.
I think he has to. He buries the market. Do you? If he starts really pulling money out.
I just don't. I think they're just between a rock and a hard place. They're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. And I think they're going to just stick with the status quo. And I think that's what the traders are thinking too.
All right, buddy. Good having you. Won't be long. We have you back because I love talking about this stuff. Keep sending me that research stuff. I enjoy reading it. So I don't know how many people you have that do, but I do. S&P futures down 15. NASDAQ futures down 106. This is after the 0.9% CPI number, which came in super hot. We'll see what happens. Let's talk about it tomorrow morning.
What do we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.